Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined by Katie Schaefer for episode 100. Might not be our favorite thing to talk about, but we're talking all about Kingdom Hospital today. Katie, thank you so much for joining me for this very special milestone here.
Yeah, no problem. I'm glad I was able to make it on for this one, even though the show is sure something. Sure something.
That is one way to put it, because this is technically an adaptation of something that Stephen King did not do originally. It's an adaptation of a show called The Kingdom, which is not an English show, not an American show by any means, but here we are, and he definitely made some changes from what I understand. I have not seen the original, but you know, this is a 2004 TV series. It lasted one season, and Katie and I are both thankful for that.
Yes, yes. And he was originally inspired by this. It's Lars von Trier, who's a controversial director and writer, to say the least.
Yeah.
And not my personal favorite or in anywhere near the top 10. But I've heard that this show is good, and that it doesn't, since it was on television in Denmark, I believe, it wasn't as problematic as some of Trier's other work. But apparently King really liked the original show, and so that's how he got into making his own kingified version of it.
And it is certainly kingified, but before we dive into the story, I want to briefly touch on the cast, because it's a very interesting cast, to say the least. You have Andrew McCarthy, who is sort of from the Brat Pack era of movies. You know, he's in, what is it, Pretty in Pink and a bunch of other movies like that. You have Bruce Davison, who looks like he's going to pop a vein in every scene that he's in. And
yep,
it's one of those things where you just look at the cast as a whole and you're kind of like, I don't even know why some of these people said yes to this show.
Yeah, I agree. Especially Andrew McCarthy. I mean,
yeah,
I suppose he's been in other King works, but he's definitely the most accomplished and well-known actor who's in this, except maybe Ed Begley Jr., who I loved that even though he's in pretty much every episode, gets special appearance by on every, as his credit. So he negotiated that very special, very particularly, and I'm sure it increased his pay amount too.
Was Andrew McCarthy in another King thing?
I thought he was. I thought he was in one of the movies.
Huh.
But I think he is definitely doing the best out of the cast in this. I mean, not that anybody else is bad per se,
right,
but he's definitely selling his role, which is a pretty out there role, in a way that none of the rest of them can. Everyone else kind of feels like they know what they're making and they're giving it just that much interest.
Yeah, one of the other big names in this is Jack Coleman. He's been in a ton of stuff. You also have Diane Ladd, Jamie Harold, Julian Richings, who is on the cover of the DVD box set that I have, and, you know, the individual DVD cases. And I was like, this guy isn't even like a huge part. And I think just because of the way he looks and those big glasses they put on him, it was kind of like the perfect imagery for this.
Yep, exactly. He's on the cover of mine, too. And I was like, okay. I mean, this guy looks weird. And that's definitely a way that they tend to sell King stuff, is this person looks weird.
Yeah.
So I could see why they did it. But yeah, the character plays almost no affecting role in this story.
No, other than he has a dog.
Yep, he has the dog. And
yeah,
but he is in the first episode quite a bit and then almost completely drops out except for random scenes. So maybe they felt like he was the introducer to the show, because he is very much in those first scenes that we see in the hospital.
Yeah, and I was looking and I didn't see Andrew McCarthy in anything else, but he was in something called Night of the Running Man. So maybe that was what we were thinking, but
yeah, I must have been, what's the other one, the guy who's in The Dead Zone? I get the two of them confused a lot.
Ah, okay. Anthony Michael Hall,
that's it. Yep.
All good. He was also in a bunch of those movies at the time, you know, Breakfast Club and things like that. But
yep,
one character who did appear actually in The Dead Zone was one of the EMTs, Benjamin Ratner. his name was Ollie in this, and he was in one or two episodes of The Dead Zone, and, you know, there were 80 episodes of that that I sat through for whatever reason I decided I needed to do that. And it was fun just seeing sort of those character actors kind of pop up in multiple Stephen King things too, because that's something I've enjoyed noticing. It's like, okay, you have a bigger actor like Gary Sinise, who is in, you know, the 90s Stand, and then he pops up in The Green Mile for like a minute. But you get a lot of people who return to King adaptations, and this was just such an interesting one. I was like, okay, you know, I don't know who else ends up in other things of his, but you definitely have some people in this who are just such classic character actors too.
Yes, and I do think they get their shot in this. You know, their character work is where they're excelling, and that's kind of what they're asked to do, is give their most wild performances, which really a lot of character actors, you just kind of play the same role over and over again, or you're in the background a lot, so you don't get to be kind of the crazy center of attention. And it feels like in this, everybody gets several of those moments where they just get to be wild and out there.
Absolutely. But where things get really confusing is the story, because you don't really know why things are happening until what, the last couple episodes?
Yeah. I mean, even the last episode, like, it really doesn't get into it until like the last 30 minutes or the last 15 minutes of episode 12. And then it gets explained in the finale. But I think because it's episode 12 where we start to get the flashbacks of what actually happens to Mary, mm-hmm. that we then see repeated like three times throughout the rest of the show. I made a lot of notes about this one. When I read over them, it repeated again and again how nonsensical it is, and how so many of the different random characters that come in and the story asides and plot points just fizzle out and don't really matter. And it kind of feels like King wrote this story and kind of wanted it to be both a monster of the week type situation, or a story of the week, and then also have an ongoing thing. It almost feels like proto-current television, where now, you know, they are willing to devote a lot of time and attention and energy of a show to one plot line, and everything else kind of takes a back seat. And in this, he tries to have it both ways, leading to a really mixed up show that is very hard to follow.
Yeah, eventually I just started focusing on the Easter eggs in it, because I was like, all right, I kind of feel like this story isn't really going anywhere per se. And I want to note that the way it starts out is actually inspired by true events, because Stephen King was hit by a van where the driver was distracted by his dog. He ended up with a broken leg, broken hip, I think some fractured ribs. He was really, really beat up. And I guess at the time there were rumors going around that he had died. And obviously not true. We have many years of Stephen King work to prove that. And
And that's why we got the End of the Dark Tower series.
Yes. And with this, it really felt like he was trying to figure out how he could take his real life experience and combine it with the original version of the kingdom and make something that would become his own. But at the same time, when he threw in the whole thing about, what was it, the mill fire, and then it was a mall, and then that burned down, and you're just like, okay, so every 70 some odd years, things burn down to the ground, and they can't figure out why these earthquakes are happening. Obviously, when you're in pretty much all of the East Coast, earthquakes aren't common.
No. To say the least, man. Like, it's... Yeah, those plot points. And they don't really go anywhere. I mean, much of the
earthquakes do get explained, at least.
Yes. And the mill fire.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't coalesce into a comprehensive story at the end. It's kind of like oh, shit, where were we going with this? That's the storyline. Let's go with that.
Yeah, because it opens with the fire and all of those child slaves burning. And you're just like, this is a really weird way to open a show about a hospital.
Yeah. Yep.
And it takes them so long. It's not like they're giving you little pieces episode by episode. It feels like they were like, okay, let's start big. Let's show them the fire. And then they wanted to let you get to know the characters. But then they just start singing, which is apparently a reference to the singing detective. Bad. I don't really know what that is. But I was like, why do we need that? We don't need this.
From what I could gather, that stuff is, and the, a lot of the other dark humor in it is from the original show, from the Lars von Trier thing. And he, von Trier executive produced this, so he was somewhat involved in like the writing, and he gets a writing credit, so he was heavily involved in it. And it's, that's more his style, and I can see, because he does his best in all of his work to unsettle his audience by having... you like, there's no trusting any expectations because anything can happen. And I think that's where that comes from, because it does not feel in line with the rest of the tone of the story or anything else. It's just like, oh, it, what is this, Twin Peaks? Like, no, no, David Lynch can get away with that and nobody else.
Yeah, this really felt like it was trying to be very Lynch-esque in its execution, and it didn't get there. And, you know, so basically the premise of the story is that there is this hospital that was built on top of this land where there had been multiple fires over the years, and this little girl ghost was coming back to kind of haunt the place, as was this older boy. And then the anteater Antibus appears to Peter after the accident, and you're kind of like, okay, so is this creature real? Because in that moment, it looks very real. But then every other time we see it, it has sort of this ghost-like look to it, the same way the girl and the boy do. And I was kind of like, okay, so the anteater clearly protects the girl. I guess the anteater's like a figment of her imagination, kind of, because we never really get that part explained.
They give some kind of an explanation of it very briefly in the last episode, which I just watched before we started recording. So that's okay. Why I remember it, because it is incredibly brief. The anteater is death. And it either chooses, like, it, from a very classical mythological interpretation of death, like Anubis or death from Neil Gaiman's Sandman series or something like that, to the point where the character later on starts to really look like the death character from the Sandman series, which I found weird, and I wasn't sure if it was on purpose or not.
Yeah.
But that's what he's supposed to be, is he's the guiding spirit who helps choose when people die.
So the girl just kind of decided to tag along.
Yeah, he tries to save her so that by the end they can rescue her in the past and prevent all the deaths from happening, is my understanding. But yeah, again, it wasn't, a lot of this is inferred from random statements that the characters make, and then they brush along and continue, and it's not necessarily supported by the text. So that was my best interpretation.
Yeah, there was so much to keep track of by the end, because they were like, let's pile all this information on you in the last two episodes, or three episodes technically, because I believe when it aired, the finale was actually two separate episodes, but they just made them one for the purpose of the DVD release. At least I think that's what happened. But anyway, you have all of this stuff happening, and you're trying to keep track of all these other storylines. You have various relationships going on with Dr. Abelson and Dr. Stegman. And then you have the sort of budding relationship between Dr. Hook and Dr. Draper. So you're kind of like, okay, does Dr. Hook actually live in the basement, or is this just where he goes when he doesn't have a lot of time off in between shifts? And it seems like he lives there full time, which is kind of weird, because, like, why would you want to do that?
Yes. Yes. Why would you do that? It's creepy. It's super creepy down there. And, like, why would you not want some time away? And yeah, he just seems little too invested in the hospital at times.
Yeah, and then he has his little graveyard of, you know, malpractice mistakes, basically, that all of the doctors have made over the years. And he shows it to Dr. Draper, not really knowing how she's going to react. And he's obviously hard on himself and actually wants to be a good doctor, whereas Stegman is just narcissistic and thinks he is above everyone else. And you see that with, what is it, his Jag that he drives. And yes, it just slowly gets taken apart over the entire season. And that feels like it's kind of in line with what happens to his character throughout the season as right. well. So you have that parallel there. But at the same time, it was just like, did we need all of those scenes with his car?
No, we didn't. It just doesn't really serve to do anything other than show us how irrational and like out of touch with reality he is. But there are so many other opportunities that the show takes to show us that. It feels repetitive at a certain point, like with the car thing and how angry he gets, and then how long they go into the malpractice stuff with him. Mm-hmm. It's just like, okay, we get it. He's not a good person. Let's focus on something else. Like, because his villainy is never really the problem with the show. Like, he's not the main villain here. Mm-mm. He's just some incompetent idiot who makes things worse in the hospital. And it's just another example of, like, a bad doctor. And that's puzzling that they spend so much time on it.
And all of the time spent on the car could have been better used elsewhere, because there are the two orderlies who have Down syndrome.
Oh, the problematic nature of those characters. Oh, it's so uncomfortable.
I wanted more explained about them, because they obviously have some sort of ability to know that certain things are going on. Like, they kind of know about the ghosts, it seems like. They know when things are happening, even though they spend a lot of time in what appears to still be the basement. I don't know. It feels like this hospital has like three different basements at times.
Yes, it's mostly basement. And then the rest of the hospital is like two floors. Like, they had a lot of basement sets, not so many hospital sets.
Yeah, even though the building is clearly like at least, what, 4 to 6 stories?
Oh, yeah, if not more. Like, that big K symbol on the front looks like the size of a house. Like, it looks like a normal-sized big hospital that would be in that area. Like, that's the main hospital that services the, you know, the counties around it. But yeah, I really didn't care for that portrayal of those characters, because it feels like the only reason they're special is because they have Down syndrome, and that's all they're there to do.
Yeah.
And I need more from it to justify that kind of bad depiction of a minority group. It's just not a good. And I mean, this is 2004, so it wasn't as common. But King has a history of doing that kind of thing, mm-hmm. that has gotten better over the years. So it was just like, oh, not cool.
Yeah, and it has nothing to do with the people playing those characters, because they did a great job with what they were given. I just think he has this habit of, oh, you are going to be the special ones because you're different.
Yes, yes. And they, like you said, they do a great job with their performances. Like, they're interesting. And I wanted to know more about them. It was like, I would have watched a whole episode detailing, you know, who they are, how they came to the hospital, or them having an interaction with Mary and Antibus. And like, we could have gotten so much more that would have explained their characters and given us more of an insight into who they are and why they have these special powers. But instead, they're just kind of sprinkled through to make things more creepy, it seems.
Well, Katie, they had to spend so much time on the Jag. I mean, how could they possibly do that?
Yes, or on like the whole episode about the baseball player that served no purpose whatsoever in the story.
Other than the fact that King really likes baseball, I was like, oh, this is like the episode for him.
Yep. Just choices were made. And it's like, maybe they didn't have someone who was involved with American television, because who knows what Danish television is like or what their show running is like. I certainly don't. But having someone involved with American television, or at least an American television writer who could guide this process, because it kind of feels like there wasn't any of that. And they just kind of let Stephen King do whatever he wanted with it. And as much as he's a fabulous novelist, he's not very good at writing TV. And it's a very different thing to write for TV and visual medium than it is to write for to write a novel.
I would say of all of the TV originals that he's written up until this point, Storm of the Century was far and away the better one.
Yeah, and that one I haven't seen. How long is that one? Is that a miniseries?
I think it is a miniseries. The screenplay is fairly thick. It's about 300 to 400 pages, somewhere around there.
Yeah, so 4 or 5 episode miniseries. Or three episode miniseries, because usually an average script is 120 pages for a movie, so.
Yeah, I think it fell somewhere around there. But that one, it's like he got the characters right in that one. You know, the characters are kind of all over the place in this. And while Stegman is very obviously the narcissistic jerk who hates everyone, pretty much, he kind of is wishy-washy with the other characters. You know, we don't know a ton about the two orderlies with Down syndrome. We don't know a ton about Dr. Draper. We get more about Dr. Hook once we see his little lair down in the basement. But, you know, like with Otto, you're just like, well, he's kind of there.
Yeah, or the hospital itself.
Yeah.
Because it seems like there's a whole world going on within this hospital, like how it's run by that mysterious group who have that weird ritual and the hand gesture yeah. that everybody makes throughout that makes no sense. Like, there's obviously so much going on, and we don't really get any of that. And therefore, it just seems like tacked on. And it's like, well, what does this have to do with the story? Because if this is the story you're telling, then either link it to that story or dump it entirely, because it's not an interesting side note, because you don't give us enough information to make it interesting.
Right. And Peter Rickman is almost just an object for a good amount of the time that he's in the hospital and not really much of a character with his own personality. So that's a bit of a bummer there. I would say the character we kind of get to know the most is Sally.
Yes. Yes, I think so too.
Because she's the only one, until she manages to get Dr. Hook and some of the others on board, who wants to find out what is really happening with this hospital. So it felt like Sally was really the driving force behind the story, even though she wasn't necessarily the character we saw the most on screen.
Yeah, and she feels the most invested in getting to a good end. Everyone else feels like they're just trying to make it through their day, whereas she's tenacious about figuring out what's going on, and she is just like, yep, this is, nothing's going to stop me from doing this. And they give her, and Diane Ladd does a great job of not, like I said before, that everybody gets their moment to give these crazy wild performances, but Diane Ladd doesn't really go there. Like, she's very in touch with what character she's playing, and she's very good at giving that to us in all of its weird kookiness, but it still feels relatable and not too over the top. So it was easier for me to invest in her character.
Yeah, and they just threw in some weird extra storylines, like the prisoner who showed up at the hospital, and you're like, this is taking so much away from the rest of the story. You know, he does get involved in the main storyline when the boy is trying to convince him to kill people, but at the same time, you're kind of like, well, we know he has to fail.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we're on episode like 4 of a 13 episode series, so he's obviously just a plot setup point. And that's kind of what I meant by, like, the monster of the week
mm-hmm.
moments, is because of the, you know, first we get him, and then we get the guy who almost kills Peter in the beginning as his first roommate. And then we get the prisoner as the second, and then the lawyer as the third. And each of them gets their own little storyline mixed in. But it just, we know it's temporary, so it's not very interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of little bits and pieces that go off, like the whole story with the Reverend. And you're just like, what does this have to do with anything? And the truth is nothing, nothing at all.
Yep. And then what they do with Elmer, like, holy God, what a terrible character choice. Like, he's pretty likable the first two episodes. And then once he starts creeping on Dr. Massengale, it just turns gross. And then that they have to have sex in order to get out of whatever creepy other world they're in, and like that happens multiple times. It's just uncomfortable and bad, especially because her character so obviously does not want this relationship. And so it feels rapey and gross that it continues, and then it forces those two characters together again and again, as though it's trying to get her to see, oh no, really, Elmer's a great guy. I mean, he cuts off patients' heads and gives them to you in a bag as a funny joke for some reason, but he's a totally normal individual.
Yeah, I don't know if I have too much more to say about the story, just because it was so all over the place. And I know we try to lean more positive, but with this one, it was just really hard to get through. And I got through it pretty quickly. I think I was doing two or three episodes at a time. And at one point, I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to look for the fun Easter eggs, and there are quite a few in this. So do you have anything else about the story before we move on to some of these Easter eggs?
You made the right choice to only watch it in two or three episode chunks. I watched like five or six episodes last night.
I'm so sorry.
By the end, like, but I, like you, I do try to look for the more positive stuff and the little Easter eggs. And I did want to say that I think for the most part, the production values in the show, except some of the special effects, especially near the end, are pretty good. Like, it's a well-shot show. It looks a lot better than a lot of like the 90s miniseries that he had. So that I was surprised by it, how well done it is. And it did get an Emmy nom for special effects, I believe, once it was finished. But yeah, the Easter eggs, and my personal favorite one was the short timers that the evil doctor keeps calling them, which is insomnia reference.
I actually did not catch that one. I was trying to catch as many as I could, and some of them were like in episode one, Peter was wearing a Little Tall sweatshirt.
Yep.
So, you know, Little Tall Island, big deal. That is where Dolores Claiborne takes place. I also believe that is where Storm of the Century takes place, too.
Oh, okay.
So there's that connection there. You have a Nurse Bannerman in this who barely gets mentioned by name. And I was like,
which one is she from?
Well, I figured this was just a nod to, you know, Sheriff Bannerman from Cujo and
that's right,
all of those things. I mean, the Bannerman name comes up in The Dead Zone as well, because in the TV series, they kind of combine two characters to give us Walt Bannerman. And the nurse's name is Nurse Brick Bannerman. And she's in 11 episodes, but you kind of don't notice her.
Oh, yes. I know which nurse you're talking about. Yep.
Yes.
Played by Beverly Elliott. Yes, I didn't catch the Bannerman connection because I haven't seen the Dead Zone show. That's on my list of to watch. Yeah, there were little bits of Dark Tower because that insomnia short timers reference is a Dark Tower thing. And I really enjoyed those bits of it, especially because it's set in a hospital. And those are that's where most of that stuff takes place, in the hospital.
You also have the fact that the hospital is in Lewiston, a frequent location mentioned in Stephen King books, but most prominently in Pet Sematary, probably.
That's right. Isn't that where it takes place? Or right outside it, that's where the college he works at is?
Yeah. And in that same episode where they mention that the hospital is in Lewiston, you have the maintenance guy, one of 18 maintenance people, reading Bag of Bones.
Yes. Yes, and there's tons of Stephen King books in this. And they even mention his name in one of the, like, news reports. And then he comes as the final maintenance guy, Johnny B. Goode, which is, of course, what he chose for his character name.
Yeah, and I think Peter's wife was reading Misery at one point, sitting next to him in the hospital room. And you just have a lot of these little things that you're like, okay, you know, these are the things I guess I came here for, because everything else is
Yeah, and I did have to say that I think the music stuff feels very, like the choice of music in this feels very much a throwback to King's books, because it's very common at the beginning of his chapters for him to use like a rock and roll quote. You know, AC/DC is one of his bigger bands, and the Ramones wrote that song for Pet Sematary. And I think the song that plays throughout this that Peter is listening to when he gets hit by the car, fairly certain that is an original song for this. But the music drops that they use, so inappropriate. So inappropriate. Like that final scene, the big final scene, they're playing this rock song. And it's like, guys, no, this is an intense moment here. We need intense music, not this. So that also felt very true to his style. And the ending in general felt very true to Stephen King's style.
There was also a mention of the Emperor of Ice Cream.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, God.
Which he's brought up in Salem's Lot, Insomnia. I haven't gotten to Just After Sunset yet, but apparently it appears in one of those short stories. So it's sort of a running theme for him to use that phrase. And it's from a poem by Wallace Stevens.
Oh, okay. The Emperor of Ice Cream.
So not necessarily a King Easter egg, but it's something that he's used multiple times in multiple books of his as well as this. But yeah, I don't think I caught too many other things. I'm sure there are a bunch, because there always are with King adaptations and King TV shows. And he just puts those things everywhere. I don't know if I've shown you the poster that has like all of the connections, and it's like this massive thing with just lines everywhere.
Yes. It looks like an evidence dungeon wall.
Yeah.
It's just strings from one thing to the next, and everything connects, which is part and parcel of why Stephen King is who he is and why some of us read his work, because it's fun to find those little connections. And you know that if he's involved in something, we're going to get, you know, a little nod to his other work. And it's an interesting, and for those who've read The End of the Dark Tower or know the conclusion of it, you know that that's a big part of how he writes in general.
Absolutely. Well, is there anything else that you want to touch on, Katie, before we wrap up here?
I did want to talk a little bit about the ending, because I think, you know, we always make time to talk about endings on when we do the show together. And I think this one in particular suffers a lot from the more cheesy choices that he tends to make in his work. And there's a couple of things that feel like Deus Ex Machina that don't, like the moment where he's drawing the fire extinguisher and just that whole idea that, oh, well, this fire extinguisher will work. It'll fix things and save the children. Like, that's not how fire extinguishers work, but okay. It just feels a little tacked on and not well put together, like most of the show. So what did you think of the ending and their choice of how to finish it off?
Honestly, for me, it was too much of a happy ending.
Yeah, it felt like more people should have died, unfortunately.
It didn't feel like a King ending because, one, it was very finalized, and two, too many of them survived.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, nobody, I don't think anybody dies who in that final episode. No, not even Stegman dies. Like, and that weird moment where they're like, season two, maybe we get a season two. Where at the final moment, it's Dr. Stegman standing there like, I'm going to get them. Like, sir, you just had your hand cut off. You're not going to be working at this hospital anymore.
No, and then the whole thing where Stegman just blows off, you know, his girlfriend, and she's just in the limo by herself or whatever. I don't know if it was necessarily a limo, but she has a chauffeur, basically. And, you know, it's just like their whole thing was too much.
Yes, that was one of those things that did not need to be in there, or at least in there that much, because it just doesn't, it feels unnecessary. Like, most of Stegman's plot feels unnecessary because it's just, it never really goes anywhere. And he said that he had set up storyboarded out a second season of this show. And so maybe that was where he was going to go with it. And maybe that's why we got so much of that character. But it really doesn't fill the need that I think he thought it would in the first season. Thankfully, the only season.
I wonder if his incident was just too fresh for him to sort of not want a happy ending for this one.
Yeah, I could see that too. Because that happened in 2002 or 2001, something like that.
Yeah, it was right before the three Dark Tower books came out back to back to back. And I think that was 2003 and 2004, where all three of those dropped within like 18 months of each other or something.
Right. Yeah, it's like, yeah, 2000 looks like it was after his accident. 1999, June 19th, 1999 is when it happened, according to CNN.
This aired in 2004, but it had to have been in the works prior to that, because I think what happened was it started airing in March, but then it got pushed because of the NBA finals. So it didn't really wrap up until the summer. And that must have been a weird experience, not getting sort of the full season all at once. It seems like it was like a part A and part B almost.
Right. I'm sure that contributed to the wonkiness of how it aired contributed to whether or not we got that second season, because it would have, especially then, before TV was what it is now, it's like, I don't really need to remember to sit down to watch this because I've completely forgotten about what happened before.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was kind of my, I think, unfortunately, this was not one of his better ones. And I wouldn't even say it's worth watching for completionness, because if I hadn't had to do this podcast, I don't think I would have finished it. I think I probably would have made it like three episodes in and been like, I don't know what the hell is going on here. This makes no sense.
I'm just determined to put my guests through misery with me.
Well, I'm happy to watch it to talk to you about it, but if I hadn't had a reason to keep going, like, it would have just been too weird and too...
Yeah.
And I like weird. Don't get me wrong. I love weird. Like, Yorgos Lanthimos is one of my favorite directors, and I love David Lynch's stuff and all that, but it's got to have a point and a purpose, and both of those things feel like they're lacking in this show.
Yeah, this is one of those things where I'm like, I have the box set. Is anyone going to want to buy this?
Yeah. You'll take it to Half Price Books and they're like, we'll just recycle this right now.
Yeah, it's funny because I actually bought it at a bookstore that's similar to Half Price. It wasn't one of them, but it was like half off books or something back in California. And I was
lucky.
Oh, look, I found Kingdom Hospital finally, because I didn't want to pay like the Amazon price for it. I was like, $30? No, we don't want to do that.
Which I ended up having to do because I could not find it anywhere. And like, it's barely in print. I think it still took like a week for me to get it, because I had to order it from like a second, like not Amazon itself, like a secondhand seller. So it was just like, oh my God. But I saw some on there for like $80 or $90. Yep. And I was like, nobody should pay that price for this.
No. I don't even know what rating I would give this. Maybe like a 2 out of 5, just because, like you said, the production value was there. And when you dive into the story about why Mary is there and haunting the hospital, it gets better, but it still has too many weird offshoot storylines.
Yeah, I think this could have been, if they had tightened it down to maybe 5 or 6 episodes, this would have been much better, because
even 8. I'll give them 8.
Yeah, the Mary story is what's interesting here, and that thread going through it and the ghosts and the haunting. And like, I just would have loved to see so much more of that and so much less just, here, let's talk about this random person. Nope, now we're talking about this rando. Like, and if they'd had less time and had to really edit this, I think it would have been a better show. I think that's fair. 2 out of 5. The bones are good. It's just the development was not where it needed to be.
Yeah, it really wasn't, which is a bit of a bummer, because sometimes Stephen King goes just weird enough to where it's enjoyable, but this like went too far in the weird direction, especially once the doctors start singing. Yep. I was like, the first time that happened, I was just like, oh no, uh-oh.
Yeah, that doesn't work. It's just, yeah, the weirdness level is not in equality to the story level. And like, you gotta have both. Like, the weirdness has to add to the story, not distract from it. Exactly. And that's what it feels like it does.
Yeah, even a German Shepherd couldn't save this show, so.
No, it could not. That was, what was it named? Blondie?
Yeah.
Oh. And that's the German Shepherd owned by the German security guard named the German Shepherd after Hitler's dog, because that was Hitler's dog's name, and it was a German Shepherd.
Yeah, I was like, it's an awkward callback, okay?
And maybe that's in the von Trier version, too, because von Trier's got some interesting views, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, Katie, thank you so much for being willing to watch this just to talk to me. And I know it was a rough time, but it's appreciated. Episode 100, I somehow made it.
Yes, and it's awesome to be here on episode 100 with you.
I don't know how I did it, but, you know, I think as of right now, I have about 60 more episodes planned, and that doesn't include any future King writings that have yet to be announced or adaptations that have yet to be announced, which I'm sure there will be many. But as of right now, you know, through the end of next year, we'll have a solid number of episodes for you guys.
Yep, yep, and we'll be glad to talk about them, even when they're as bad as this one. I mean, nothing can be as bad as the Tommyknockers, okay? This is better than the Tommyknockers, both the book and the movie.
Yeah, I would highly agree with that. So, Katie, I'm sure you'll be back on soon for something else. You always are, and thank you again.
Thank you.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.